This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
And we are live here at the spoiler room. We've got the spoiler room crew, and tonight we are going to dance our magic, baby, as we talk some 80s children's, and I put that in quotes, children's movies that I believe we've all watched as we grew up, and it explains a whole hell of a lot. But first, let's look at who's in the spoiler room tonight. We've got Dawn. How you doing, Dawn?
Just fabulous.
Beautiful, beautiful. Glad to have you on the spoiler room again. Glenn, how are you doing tonight? Oh, what do you got there?
Porn.
Dark Crystal.
Oh, it is Dark
Crystal. Concept art by Brian Froud, who did most of the creature designs for Dark Crystal.
Oh, very sweet. Nice.
And Labyrinth.
Awesome. And Derek, how are you doing tonight, Mr. Derek Carey, filmmaker extraordinaire?
I am doing very well. Here's my VHS copy of Labyrinth.
I don't have my DVD extra special edition of Dark Crystal down here to show up. I feel so inadequate now. And the last member of our spoiler room, but especially not least, is Mr. Scott Davis. How are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. I've got the right day. I'm got my stuff together again, so I'm all set.
Awesome. Well, as we've been doing in the past in the spoiler room, I want to cover a few headlines that have come up. One that literally just came across the desk this afternoon. We'll get to that one in a second, but first I want to talk about one that's actually really relevant to what we're talking about as far as 80s kids films. They are making a Goonies 2, and I wanted to get people's opinions on this. Apparently, Spielberg and Donner are both in the works on this, so it's not like they gave it off to someone else. Those Spielberg and Donner are still kicking, and they want to make a Goonies 2. Dawn, how do you feel about that?
Not very well, actually.
Dead silence is never a good sign.
I cannot really foresee how they can possibly do this and make it work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I could be wrong. I really can't see how they can possibly do this and make it work.
What about the rest of you guys? Anyone want to chime in on what they feel about Goonies 2 possibly becoming a reality?
Have they announced who's in it and what the course of action is going to be for the film?
Right now, it's just it's Donner who has interest from the original cast wanting to be in it.
Doc.
That's the wrong direction.
They're available?
Yeah. I think that's the wrong direction. If they're going to make this film, they have those people be the parents this time, and then their kids be the new Goonies.
Right, and actually that's what it says here, is that Goonies 2 would take appropriately 30 years after the events of the first film and would feature the children of Mikey, Brand, and the rest of the gang. So it would be their kids on an adventure, probably similar to what their parents went on, which I could kind of see work as
an adventure going to be. They found a giant pirate ship full of millions of dollars of treasure money. BMW fix. I don't see a need for a sequel. If you want to make a movie like Goonies for the next generation, just make a different movie. Yeah, why do you have to call it Goonies? Just that you're going to draw the parents in? If it's a kids movie, the kids are going to want to go see it.
Yeah, it's I completely agree with that. I think that I'm trying not to be cynical about it, because what is Goonies really about? It's about the sense of adventure.
Yeah. Right.
It's about these people being together and being on this sense of adventure. And you know what? If you were to ask me when I was like 10 years old, I would have rated that movie way up there, right next to any of the movies we're about to discuss. But, you know, it's going to take one of two routes, or probably it sounds from the synopsis, both routes. The parents going, I'm getting too old for this shit. And, and like the new, younger Goonies for a new generation. You know, it sounds... there are sequels to movies that have been made where I've been very impressed. Like, for instance, okay, I am a huge fanboy for Tron. Mm-hmm. I loved Tron as a kid, one of my favorite movies. And when that sequel came out, like almost 30 years later, I was like, oh my God, they finally did it. They finally, woo! And they finally did it. And I was all set for it. And I was geeking out with my friends who were younger than me, so they didn't even know what the hell I was nerding out about. And when I saw the movie, I swear to God, I loved it. I if you look back on my old on the old Film Geek Central or whatever, I think I said that it was my top film of that year. I mean, I really loved it. I thought it was as good as the first one. But that was miraculous as far as I was concerned. I couldn't believe they pulled it off. In my opinion, anyway, they did. Some people say they didn't. Sounds like, and because for years we've had Sean Astin and Corey Feldman saying, yeah, we're going to do it. They've been saying it for decades. And it really sounds like a really pathetic attempt to get these middle-aged people, of which I am now one, to relive the adventures of the years and pandering to the nostalgia thing. And it,
Well, that's exactly what this is all about. It's just a cash grab. But the thing is, I can't get too cynical about something like this because, honestly, I think if they did this right and they made it about the kids and they made this a new Goonies for a new generation and they had the same sense of wonder and they made it a fun kind of darkish film, I mean, for kids, I think it could be really great. I think Goonies... Another Goonies film would not be for us. So for us to sit and comment on it being, you know, oh, they're raping my childhood, or oh, I can't believe this. There's no way this movie could be good for us. It's not made for us. It shouldn't be for us. It should be for the little kids.
I agree with that, and I actually hope that you're right there, Derek. I really do.
Me too. I totally agree on that.
I've got Sandlot 2, Sandlot 3. There is no good thereafter, said the first.
My cynicism towards it doesn't come from the fact that it's the whole, oh, they're stealing my youth and pooping on my memories. I get like that with some things, but with this, I'm now looking at more of the I don't trust them to do justice to the name and to capture the same things, just because I've been burned enough times on stuff like this.
Right.
And just the whole thing where it's like, well, Spielberg's attached. Wasn't he attached to Crystal Skull as well?
Exactly.
Yeah. I actually like Crystal Skull, which no one,
Spielberg and Donner and those guys, I mean, when they made those films that captured wonder, they were what, in their 30s, 40s? Now they're like, they're grandpas. And to them, wonder is the, I wonder where I put my teeth.
I wonder what my checking account number is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's. I don't think they have that. They're not the same men. And what in their mind is a sense of wonder to a child is going to be based off, one, their age, and two, off of the films they made 30 years ago.
No, it depends on how far down the dementia spiral they've gone.
The tough part that I see with this is we've actually gotten a movie, a Goonies-type feel film in the last 5 years, and that was with Super 8. If you watch Super 8, Super 8 really has a Goonies feel. So my concern is that people make compare it to not the original Goonies, but to more recent, which is Super 8, which really felt like another Goonies film, only it was sci-fi versus a pirate ship. I mean, the way that was directed with the kids, it was a darker film, which you don't get a lot anymore, which is kind of why I wanted to do this podcast tonight, because most of the kids' films now aren't as dark as they used to be by any means, because of various groups and that. So, yeah, I'm curious on how Goonies 2 will come out too. I guess we'll have to hear more details. If they make it, do it right, and don't focus it so much on, oh, here's these people, I think they might actually be better. It'll be cool to see, you know, the characters revisit their... actors revisit the characters that we loved them in Goonies, but only for a brief bit and not have them be a major part of the film. And I think, yeah, Goonies might do it. I'll have to wait and see. The other headline that I wanted to cover, one of the three, it was going to be two, but the second one I wanted to cover is apparently Fox has secured the rights and is looking at making another Flash Gordon film. And me personally... I love the original Flash Gordon. I don't care how cheesy it is. I don't care how people take it, how it was a comic book film that was made before comic book films were cool. I mean, if you look at the production and the people they got in the film at the time, this would be the original 80s Flash Gordon would be considered a big blockbuster tentpole type film because of the scope and the characters and everything about it. But it was back when they were like, really? This is kind of cheesy, which it was, but now Fox wants to do one. You guys think they could do a decent modern Flash Gordon since they had that cheesy TV show a few years ago fail?
Yes.
Yes. If they could, yes. If they would have done John Carter right, John Carter could have been kind of a Flash Gordon-esque type film. So I think so. I really think so. I think they can make it even more extraordinary than the original one was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Derek, you are, you hit a nerve because I love pulp. Fiction. I love pulp literature. Love Edgar Rice Burroughs. Love the John Carter books. And when they were finally doing a John Carter film, I'm like, oh yes. And who's doing it? One of the people from Pixar. Cool. This is gonna be. And it was my worst film of the year.
It was worst.
It was terrible.
See, and I enjoy it.
He just slapped the host.
Hey, Mark, whose show is this anyway? No. Sorry, man. The one from 19. That was rude. But the one from 1980 is very cheesy. I actually like it now. Because it's corny, because it's cheesy, but let's be honest. I not to speak ill of the recently departed, but the screenwriter Lorenzo Semple Jr. handled a lot of properties which a lot of people felt like he fumbled because he did not take them seriously. Batman, King Kong, and Flash Gordon. Yeah, just to name a few. He didn't take them seriously because, in his view, you didn't take it seriously. You know, you had Sirius over here, like with 3 Days of the Condor, and then you had this, which what adult would take that seriously? Well, us. Sure. But I love looking at it. I love watching that movie. I love the soundtrack. I do love the film, but I love it because it's so cheesy.
Sure.
Can they do a real, honest-to-God, good Flash Gordon movie? Yes, absolutely. First of all, that TV series from a few years ago... flush it down the toilet because that's where it belongs. It was the worst. I couldn't believe they screwed that up that badly. But I think if handled right, they can do it. And I hope they do. And I hope they do the same with Buck Rogers. Take all those damn old heroes and bring them into the new age. But do it with respect.
I think Flash Gordon being successful is going to come down to one thing, and that's the director.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to expect a lot out of the script, to be honest. But I think for a Flash Gordon, I think you need to have someone who can capture that pulp sci-fi feel, which means you need to go with someone who's not that. This is the hard thing, is that a lot of those people who can do those really beautiful and atmospheric pieces are the people who are going to bring you a weaker story,
mm-hmm.
and it's gonna be hard getting that balance because someone like a Guillermo del Toro doing a Flash Gordon, I think, would be a beautiful thing to look at.
Mm.
But I think it would then end up being really obscure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing. Or even though his stories are atrocious, Zack Snyder makes beautiful-looking movies.
Visually, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then the story is going to be like, really? Why is everyone in green cloth?
Why is this movie 3/4 of it in slow motion?
Yes.
Where's the sense of humor in this movie?
My other fear is, who can replace Brian Blessed?
Yeah. Oh,
God, yes.
Voltan. Who can be Voltan?
who do you have that can play Voltan? Pat. Yes. Our friend.
I heard rumors Pat shaved, though.
Yeah?
No, the pictures he just posted, he had his full and manly beard still.
Oh. So, Don, what about you? Flash Gordon, interested to see how that's going to play out, if it plays out?
I'm not as passionate about the Flash Gordon. It's an amusing film. I've enjoyed it thoroughly since it came out. The soundtrack, there is nothing that can replace the Queen soundtrack.
No.
Yeah.
And that, it was an integral part of that original, that 1980s film.
Right. It definitely helped make it.
Yes.
Don't even acknowledge the 80 film if you want to go with this, because it's so unique. Mm-hmm. And obviously they should
There's
go in a different direction.
Yes, they have to go in a completely different direction.
Yeah, they've got to do it brand new and not even try to give any nods to the original. Just leave that alone into the cult artistic form that it is.
My biggest fear with this one is they're going to do what they've done with a lot of property from the 70s and the 80s, is they're going to take it and they're going to make it a comedy. That's one of my fears that they might try to do. They're going to give, like, Flash some annoying fucking sidekick.
They're going to make it
kind of buddy cop movie in space.
A big indicator as to what direction it could ultimately take will be the success of Guardians of the Galaxy. I think Guardians of the Galaxy can come out and show kind of a grand scale space opera type story and have a snarky sense of humor, which it ultimately will have with James Gunn at the wheel, but also at the same time take its subject matter seriously and show the grandeur of space, there may be where this film may get its nod. If that tanks and nobody cares, well, then Flash Gordon may go away. Guardians of the Galaxy is going to really tell you what's going to end up ultimately happening with this subgenre.
Yeah. And if Guardians of the Galaxy does well, they should let James Gunn make the Flash Gordon movie.
Yes. That would be amazing.
That would be awesome.
He was actually my first time, like, oh, if they do it, they have to get James Gunn. Mm-hmm. He would have the right amount of snark.
Right.
And I have no information to the fact, but I would bet he is a fan of the original Flash Gordon movie.
Oh yeah, sure.
I think it, and you know what? I'm just gonna say real quick. The only thing I can think of where they should, the only nod I can possibly think of to give the 1980 movie, which is not, you know, of course, naturally the first Flash Gordon film, but it's the one we all remember.
Right.
Is
as opposed to Flash Gordon.
Yeah. Well, hey, who doesn't remember that? But whose favorite movie is Flash Gordon? It's on the DVD and Blu-ray. Alex Ross.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine if they let him do some of the production design, which they should have done on Man of Steel, incidentally?
Yeah.
Can you imagine if they do that? That would be impressive.
I'm already trained to cast the movie. Bryan Cranston is Ming the Merciless.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. That would be awesome.
He could pull that off. Well, speaking of films that were both on the small screen and the big screen, this one just came in this afternoon, and here it is. Jason from Friday the 13th is heading to the small screen. As a report says, it reimagines Jason in multiple timelines. The series is contemporary, focusing on the eclectic characters of Crystal Lake, who are forced to confront the return of the killer as new secrets about his wacky family are revealed. Derek, go!
Awesome.
His wacky family?
That's what he
Is that what the copy really says?
That's what the copy says. That's the quote. They have this in quotes, so it's got to be from...
What is it titled? Jason Voorhees Adventures or something?
Friday the 13th, the series, apparently, which is really confusing because we had another one. Yeah, according to original director Sean Cunningham, will be back as executive producer, and he's saying Jason Voorhees is synonymous with the genre, and we plan to build on this legacy with a provocative and compelling take that expands upon the storylines that have already thrilled millions worldwide. Then the president, Robert Barasim of Horror Inc., says, expect the show to take viewers in some exciting new directions that we're confident will not only excite existing fans, but also attract new audiences to the situations and characters that inhabit small town of Crystal Lake. Now, top that on top of the probably found footage film of the Friday the 13th. I was reading the article. I just switched back. And I think Derek's just giving his opinion on the matter.
If you could see tears coming out of my eyes, then
if you had a burlap sack, you would hide in that, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Wow, Derek, it's like the Arsenio interview all over again.
It's just little tears.
coming out of Jason's eyes.
You know, Sean S. Cunningham, you know, they say, you know, well, yeah, but he was the guy from behind the first one and all that stuff. But you know what?
He didn't care.
No, the person who took the reign on the first bunch of sequels was that Frank Mancuso Jr. guy.
Yep.
And
for the vast majority of the series, actually.
Yeah, and when Sean S. Cunningham took a more dominant role again, that was when you did Jason Goes to Hell, where he said, I don't want to see that mask. And also Jason X, if I'm not mistaken.
Jason X. I love so, Jason X.
That's so funny.
It's really
I great. Don't think that to say, like, yay, he's back, I just like, yeah, it's kind of like, no. It's kind of like saying, the Rash is back. Oh, boy.
I couldn't disagree with you more on that, but we'll leave that for another discussion. This, yeah. Honestly.
You do know more about
just,
it than I do.
Just, yeah. Just take my money. Just where do I plunk my money down? Just do I have to pay for a subscription for this goddamn, you know, series? What do I have? Where do I got to see it? I'm not going to give opinions on it. Just show me it, and then I'll live my life afterwards. It's just not going to get any better from here on out. Just no matter what they put out there, it's depressing. You crushed my soul.
I'm sorry, Barry. When I saw that come across this afternoon, I'm like, oh, I've got to bring that to the room.
I can't wait to crush Derek's soul tonight.
I didn't mean to crush your soul.
Put your boner away, please.
I didn't mean to crush your soul, though. Glenn, no.
Seriously, it just sounds awful. It sounds does. Awful.
What about you, Mr. Buettner? Buettner. I always mispronounce your last name. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'm not a giant Friday the 13th fanboy to begin with. I mean, I like some of the movies, but this has zero interest for me. Actually, less than zero interest. If I will probably in no way seek this one out. If someone just says, "Here, watch this," and they give it to me and they give me a six pack of beer, then maybe I'll watch one episode, but. Just from the synopsis you read, I'm just like, what is this going to be?
Wacky adventures.
And where's it going to air? Because that's really going to be a big determining factor.
I was just going to say that. To do this justice and to make it feel at least somewhat like the movies, you're going to have it be on a cable show like AMC or even HBO to give it the mature treatment that it would need. If they try to market this on a broadcast, it's going to be dead after the first couple episodes.
It'll be on demand. It'll be one of these things that are on like Netflix or on like Amazon Prime or something like that. That's the only way that this will gain any sort of audience. This is not the kind of thing that I don't think would ever garner. Like if they were to put it on AMC or like an HBO, that would get the kind of, I mean, think about the nature of Friday the 13th. Friday the 13th is a popcorn commodity. It's something that you turn on, and if it's 25 minutes, you watch it for that bite-sized little bit, and you enjoy yourself, and then you move on.
Right.
It's not something that needs an hour or more, which most of the TV shows now, like The Walking Dead or Breaking Bad or any of those shows are, where these dramas. No, this is something that, like Tales from the Dark Side used to be. If you do something where you just go in 25 minutes, you get a little tiny story of Jason's past or Jason, you know, some bumbling kids with big breasts come in and they all get slaughtered and then they move on, you know, something like that. Keep it light. Keep it fun. Mm-hmm. Keep it nasty. Keep it short. And right. I think you put that on like a Netflix where you have a whole season of it and people can just watch it in little tiny bites, I think it'd be perfect. Yeah. Yep, yeah. It'd be perfect.
That's a good idea, but you know that's kind of a trend is to take these horror properties like they've done with Hannibal, which I'm only six episodes in, but I like it a lot, actually. Surprised. And Bates Motel, and now we're getting a four-part miniseries of Rosemary's Baby. They take these essentially simple stories, and they expand on them. in a TV universe, and let me tell you the origins of it, you know, and whether we give a shit or not.
Yeah. Bates Motel is just awful. I'm sorry if you guys like that, if anyone likes that. I tried watching a few episodes, and it was just awful. I just didn't understand the point of it. I didn't understand the need for it. But that's my fear is, you know, everything nowadays, and this goes to the Goonies conversation we just had and all the conversation we've really just had about this whole need for nostalgia marketing. And the only way we get new content is by plumbing the depths of all of our past memories of all of the old things that we watched when we were young to get us to buy more stuff now.
Yeah,
it's depressing. It's stupid and depressing, and I won't pay a cent for any of this, even though I'm a huge Friday the 13th fanboy. If they do this and it goes out on like a broadcast network,
yeah,
guess what? I'll stream it. And I don't ever, I never want to tell people to do that kind of thing because you take away from the artist.
Right.
But you flat out just come out and tell your audience, guess what? We just want your money. We don't care if this is any good.
Yeah.
You're going to get people that are just going to take that.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of nostalgia. Actually, go ahead, Glenn.
Well, I was going to say, if I can add a bit.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Because when Derek mentioned plumbing the depths, it reminded me of the news I heard is that Joel Hodgson, creator of Mystery Science Theater, is looking to reboot the series.
Oh.
With different host, different cast. And apparently apparently in some minor talks with, I forget if it was Netflix or Hulu or one of those. Mm. So that's a possibility of Mystery Science Theater 3000 coming back.
Yeah. That's one where they might actually get me. As long as it's better than Jim Mallon's Flash animation cartoon. Those are terrible. But I'm a Misty from way back. I was actually in Minnesota when the KTMA show premiered. I've, you know, met a very good portion of the people behind the show. I've seen all the episodes multiple times. I quote it every day. I'm annoying. And that's like
Mitchell.
Mitchell. If you look back in my high school senior yearbook, and everybody has, you know, those little quotes that they, what a strange trip it's been, and stuff like that. Next to their name, they have your little quotes. The quote next to my name, Mitchell. I actually adopted a manatee for an environmental protection thing, and I named it Mitchell because when I looked at the manatee, I said, that looks like Jodan Baker. So, yeah. No, seriously, that's, Derek, that is actually my Friday the 13th. So, yeah, they actually might get me on
I
that.
Think we all grew up, because we're all of the same age, so we all grew up watching MST3K. And it's honestly, for me, I think MST3K, while at the time it was amazing, I think it is in part the reason why we have the annoying snark culture that we have now.
A little bit.
The reason why we have ironic film viewing. And honestly, I can't get behind it anymore. I can't. I just don't get excited about it, even though I watched it like a fiend when it was originally airing. Now, because of what it created, I can't get behind it. I'm just disgusted by the whole thing, and I'm so sick of bad movie nights where people go to just sit and rib movies and be assholes and not enjoy things, and just like I'm sick of it all. So honestly, this can go f*** itself.
I'm so not hip that I don't even know what any of those things are.
Wow.
Because I'm a shut-in, I guess.
Don, did you have any opinion on
MST3? I honestly, I've only ever seen one.
Yeah.
Anytime that I saw them do something, I went and found the movie they were doing so I could watch it without the commentary.
Yeah.
Thank you.
My uncle did that when I always wondered, where did I get this weird thing? Because no one else in the family has this love of cheesy movies like I do or anything. And then one day, I think it was my Uncle Bobby was visiting, and I never got to see him. And I'm in there, and I was the MST3K episode of Killer Shrews was on. And he walked in the room, and he says, "Oh, cool, Killer Shrews is on. Who are those people at the bottom of the screen?" And that's when I knew.
See, that's my main thing is
Gene.
That's my main thing is now, and I always have been a viewer of really shitty movies and of like low rent exploitation films. Yep. I don't want to listen to people making jokes over it. I want to watch the movie.
I can do both. I can do both. I mean, MST3K did a lot of movies that I loved, that I already loved before they did them. And I watched them do it. I watched them rip them a new one. And you know what? I was totally cool with it. I'm like, yep, that's fair. Laser Blast kind of had that coming. Yep.
Well, that leads us right, talking about nostalgia, right into why I wanted to kind of do this spoiler room tonight is because I was thinking back and I was watching the latest Muppet film and I was thinking, wow, you know, a lot of the kids' films nowadays, you know, all the ones that are, they seem a little too bright for me. I don't remember that many bright, you know, we did have them. But there were ones that I remember that were ones that I look at now and go, wow, they showed that to us. They geared it towards kids. And most of them involved Jim Henson, surprisingly. So the first one I want to talk about tonight, is Neverending Story. Now, Neverending Story, for those of you who grew up or who were born when I graduated high school, if you're not familiar with the story, it's basically about this kid who is bullied, and he takes a refuge in a bookstore, and he ends up getting this book, and this book ends up transporting him to this magical place of Fantasia, which is being attacked by something called the Nothing, and he reads about the adventures of Atreyu, who tries to fight the Nothing. Now, this is a spoiler room. We're going to spoiler the hell out of it, so if you are interested in it, go watch it and then come back and listen to our spoiler room. But Neverending Story. Don, let's go with you first because you recently did a review on your blog, which everyone should go check out in the audience. So, Don, why don't you start off with your impressions, your feelings, or you know, just Neverending Story. You know, what are your impressions? Did you have fond childhood memories with this film?
I really did, actually. I loved it growing up. It wasn't a great film. I enjoyed the puppeteers. But at reviewing it, revisiting it recently, I realized it's really not a very good story. I mean, even when you completely separate it from the source material, the book, it's an incomplete story that just stops. It doesn't end. It doesn't pull in all the plot points. It just stops. And if you are not able to connect with your inner child, because all of the heroes are children, and most of the adults just kind of look down upon the kids in one way or another, or cannot connect with the kids, you're not going to be able to appreciate the fact that the kids are the heroes, and
just didn't care for the story.
I just found it incomplete, and sure. as a parent, it drove me nuts that this kid could disappear and they never went back to address it. Overnight without anybody knowing where he was, locked in an attic at school, no consequences.
Did they get anybody else?
Oh my Christ.
I was sitting there too going, you know, and I was, even when I was remembering the film before I rewatched it, I'm like, that kid was in that attic a long time and nobody came to look for him.
I only realized that this time, because I always thought when I was a kid, like, well, no, he's there during, you know, school hours, and probably, like, when school is over, he just goes out. And then I watched it last time, I'm like, no, he's there all night.
Well, that's one of the things about this film that I think, you know, kind of spans the generations that many different people can watch it, is that it does give the two perspectives. It really is a film for kids from their perspective about what a fantasy world and escapism is and how they view parents. But as a parent, when you look back on it, because I've watched this probably once every year or once every other year, because I've loved it since I was a kid. I saw it in the theater multiple times when I was young, and then it was a staple on cable television growing up. So I've seen this movie dozens of times. And you really do start thinking about, why is this kid locked? Like, why is nobody coming to try and find him in this attic forever?
Well,
you know?
And how about that attic, too? It's already got melted candles there. So people have camped up here before. I mean,
and what kind of a school has a stuffed wolf's head just laying around?
An awesome one?
Obviously, I didn't go to that awesome school.
Gwen, what about you? Fond memories or never ending story when you revisited? Anything that changed for you?
The number of times that I have just out of the blue at work or at the grocery store or wherever, when I have to pick something up or do something, the number of times I've gone, they look like big, strong hands. I love this movie. I absolutely love it. There's parts of it that I mock the hell out of as well. I mean, I even mocked it when I first saw it, when it's like, I'm a luck dragon. You're a cocker spaniel. That is not a dragon. That was part. I remember being a kid and seeing the first time, being like, that's not a dragon. That's a dog. I know what a dragon looks like. I've seen the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon. It's not a dragon. But I still love the movie. And the whole thing, I never really paid any attention to the whole the kids off and no one's looking for him, because I was kind of like that kid where I would be gone for God knows how long. The only thing is, maybe if I missed dinner, my parents might notice. But it was just except the fact that I was off doing stuff. I was lost in a book. I was in a field somewhere just doing my Glenn stuff. So that part never hit a note with me, because that was, in a lot of ways, kind of like how my childhood was, where I was off in my own world that my parents, for the most part, didn't understand, but they accepted the fact that this is my world, and I was safe in it, because I never came back, you know, I came back filthy, but I never came back missing a limb or anything like that either, and there were never, you know, the cops weren't following behind me, so.
God, no,
this is one of my childhood favorites.
What about you, Scott?
I wasn't even allowed to leave the driveway when I was a kid. I want to swap childhoods with Glenn. It sounds adventurous and full of whimsy and wonder. And
I want Glenn's childhood. He wants Glenn's never-ending story.
Scott is a quivering mass of just tears.
I'm having an existential crisis over here.
You can have it, Scott. Just say my name. Just say my name.
Three times.
Can any of you, since you've watched it, I've watched it many, many times, what the hell is his mom's name?
Well, here's the thing. I got a thing for that, because when I only now recently found out what he said, and I thought, that's stupid. because he says early in the movie, he says, I would have given her my mom's name. She had such a beautiful name. I'm like, oh, well, that's kind of sweet. And then when he finally yells it, you know what he yells? He yells, Moonchild.
Moonchild?
Moonchild. Yep. So everyone's like, his mom's name was Moonchild? That's weird. Yep. And here's the thing. Apparently in the book, I just started the book last night. The movie inspired me to read the book finally. I never read it.
I'm sorry.
And so I just started it, but I would have to fall asleep before I could get too far. So I actually did find a lot of people saying, yeah, his mom's name is Moonchild. What's the thing? Well, maybe it's a German thing. Mond Kid. Nope, that's not a real name. She's too young to be a hippie. She would have been too old to be a hippie parent, you know, so that couldn't be. But I got this thing from Yahoo Answers, and I'm going to, like, read for it now, real quick. He says, a lot of people debating it and everything like that, and this one person does this very lengthy thing about, you know, the book and the movie and everything like that. The guy says, quote, Andrew R. from Yahoo Answers, I very highly doubt that his mother's name was Moonchild Books. Now, in the book, this is a quote, now in the book, Bastion never makes the claim that he will give the childlike empress his mother's name. In fact, it never comes up at all. When faced with the decision to let Fantasia the movie, name the Golden Knight. Well, here he has grammatical problems. But anyway, he says, and he names her Moonchild, which by naming her he showed his power of imagination and the power to create worlds with it. In other words, it was just somebody that was from a name that was from his imagination in the book, and it was not the mother's name. And only in the movie did they think that. But I think it's like what Dawn said. I think it's one of those unconnected threads that they just dropped. Honestly, right. And it's led to 30 years of confusion.
I'm just glad I'm not the only one. Because you can't understand him hardly. So
I only found out, really, what he said about, like, 2 months ago. Someone said it in a Facebook post. And I'm like, what is that? Is that what he yells? Yeah. Why? That's his mother's name.
Also, it happens to be in the IMDb trivia. Oh.
Yeah, okay. I didn't. Yeah,
slapped down.
Got me.
By the way, the first half of the book is excellent. The second is, that's the part I'm sorry for.
Well, it is the never-ending story.
Uh-huh.
Looks like I'll find out. I'll have to touch base with you when I get there. Like,
now, Derek, I don't think we got you. You mentioned that you watch it like every other year. Did you have any fond childhood memory of the movie?
Oh yeah, I used to love watching this movie because I think it evokes that sense of escapism when you're a child, how that books give you, that when you open it up, the entire world just falls away and you become part of this universe. And I always loved that. I always thought that it was fantastical. It was mysterious, it was dark, it was brooding, but it was also kind of whimsical with the dragon being the Cocker Spaniel and stuff like that. I always loved it. I think it's a great children's film. I really think it's one of the greats of that era, and it's from an era where they were kind of adventurous about the kids' films, and that's the three films we're talking about tonight perfectly exemplify that, where they were willing to go places that nowadays they definitely would never do.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was rewatching Neverending Story last night. I watched it by myself because my kid's sensitive to death, and I tell you, that's still gut-wrenching, the whole scene in the swamp with Artex and Atreyu and the horse. I'm like sitting here watching this going, man, I still find this thing brutal as I did when I was a kid. I'm like, that's a really dark and sad scene that they're talking about, you know, that they present there. And then you add on that wolf, which to this day creeps the hell out of me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I've got to say, Noah Hathaway did an amazing job of carrying that movie.
Mm-hmm.
For a child actor, he did an outstanding job.
Which they couldn't replicate with the sequels.
No. Nope. No, not.
I don't think I ever saw the sequels.
Brandis and whoever else, they just couldn't do the same as what Noah did, and it blows me away. Of course, the guy playing Bastion was pretty good, but that's because he was like the kid actor of the 80s. I mean, he did, he was Daryl, he was, he was all over the place, and then he just disappeared.
I know what he's doing now. That's the funny thing, is that this is in the IMDb stuff, I think. Barrett Oliver, I hate him.
Oh, okay.
I hated his performance. I've always hated him in this movie, and I hated him even more now. I think if there's a
Frankenweenie. He was Frankenweenie.
Which I never did see, honestly.
He was great in Frankenweenie. I mean,
film. I didn't see it. You know why I didn't see it? The dog does come back to life, the dog does have to die first. I can't do it.
Oh yeah.
That's the thing that gets me. I love dogs.
So did the horse get you when it
died?
Yeah,
my dog got a huge hug in that scene. Yeah, a huge hug. I'm not ashamed to admit it. That's my baby. But anyway, yeah, Barrett Oliver. I don't like him. Have you seen Daryl recently? It sucks.
well, tell us how you truly feel, Scott.
It sucks. and he's also the weak link in Cocoon. The thing is that he's terrible at this. I always thought he was like just such a little spaz. You know, if there's any reason why he gets beat up and no one goes to look for him, it's because he's Barrett Oliver. But now it's funny. He's retired from acting. You know what he does now? He now runs a tattoo shop in L.A.
Does he really?
He runs a tattoo shop. So, I mean, it says he's happily married and stuff, but I kind of like to picture him as, like, kind of like this, like, the stereotypical tattoo shop owner who's, like, kind of, like, scuzzy and has piercings, like,
wow.
And just, wow. Like, the girls come in, like, yeah, I remember that moon child, and ooh, it's not real, yeah. That's me. That was me. I probably was like all over your childhood and everything. Now who wants me to tattoo a woman on their
You need to smile more, Scott. You really need to smile more.
Okay. Well, the horse scene,
I don't like her at all.
Getting back to the horse scene though, that was the dark scene. And there are a few other scenes I think that stood out as being dark and scenes that you wouldn't see now, I think, in a kid's movie nowadays. Were there any scenes for you guys besides the horse one that maybe stood out that was just like a really dark, you know, kind of not a happy place for a kid's film to be?
Glenn nailed it earlier.
When he's the whole, you know, big, strong hand. I mean, he's basically sitting there saying, you know, the nothing's coming, and he's pretty much given up. I mean, he's pretty much doing he's basically committing suicide. He is going to sit there, let this nothing take him, and that's it. He's quit. I mean, that's a pretty dark scene.
Because this nothing ripped, even though he tried to hold on with all his might, this nothing ripped his best friends and confidence right from his grip and turned them into nothingness. That is, I watched that and I was like, whoa, that's the one part of this movie, because I really didn't like it too much when I watched it again recently, honestly. I'm with Dawn on that. But that's the one part where I was like, whoa, okay, this part kind of gives me chills. You know, this was a really deep thing to put in a kid's movie that you're not going to see today outside of, like, Toy Story 3.
Well, I mean, that...
Come on, Toy Story 3 isn't deep.
Oh, come on!
It's Toy sentimental.
Toy Story 3 had that whole big thing where they're going in the furnace towards the... That was... That's the only thing I can compare to, like,
they're
the kind
toys.
Of...
toys!
It didn't matter if they were toys because they were, you know, sentient in the film universe. So, and to these kids that are watching it, they are as real as you and me. But that's like getting the thing.
Well, what about Dawn? You have any or Glenn? Any scenes outside of the horse and the? You mentioned the big strong hands, Glenn. What about you, Dawn? Anything, or did those two really be the darker?
Those would be the darker. I was thinking about the scene where Atreyu kills Gmork, but that's
in modern,
I don't think that's too unusual.
Well, but the discussion that they have, I think, might be a little bit unusual, and this whole movie in general. I mean, the nothing. Let's face it, the nothing is a whole metaphor for for me, the way I took it watching it this time is a metaphor for possibly not just loss of imagination, but death. I mean, like you mentioned, the big strong hands, the guy just had his friends ripped away from him, sucked into the nothing. I'm looking at this going, holy crap, the nothing is the metaphor for death.
I would think apathy more than death.
Or apathy?
Apathy, yeah. Apathy.
The loss of the childhood sense of wonder. It's growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some dark scenes, but we had some scenes in here too that I don't think ever would make it into a kid's film, like the oracles. It's the first time I really noticed the oracles have breasts, like with nipples, and the statues are pretty explicit. And I'm like,
boobs.
I couldn't. Well, no, it's just something that I noticed that I'm like, That would never make it in a movie nowadays. You'd have at least, you know, three different groups out there going, well, the never-ending story, it's got smut, it's got these naked statues in it.
Yeah, people take themselves way too seriously these days. I tell you, I was planning to, if there was anything I expected to shout out while watching rewatching the never-ending story after over a decade or so, two decades or so, I swear to God, I never expected to be yelling, Oh, look at those! Nice work, oracles.
Oh my gosh. Holy crap.
But that was the old 80s PG where, you know, you could show a duck person's breasts and still get with a PG. So,
Roger Moore's Battle Beyond the Stars, the main hero, the Millennium Falcon of that piece, had boobs.
Yeah, that's true.
It was awesome. And I loved that movie. And you know what? I didn't turn out to be, well, maybe I did, but I don't think that it had a negative effect on me to say, like, yeah, the spaceship's got boobs. It gave me a giggle, but then I moved on, you know?
Well, besides that, though, I mean, there's some other things, too, in here, just in general, that I don't think would make it today just because people might find it a little offensive, you know? One of the places I wanted to go with it, though, was I was watching it, and I realized why I was enjoying it even more now than before and why I enjoy it more than most of the kids' films that have come out. It's all practical. Derek, I want to get your view on this. When you're watching this, and they're good practical effects. Sure, the mouths don't exactly move quite right, but overall, the sheer volume of practical effects and makeup and costumes, even in the background, is crazy. I mean, does that stand out for you too, Derek?
I think that all of the films that we're going to talk about here today, I think that's the reason why these films stand the test of time, is that there's pure artistry going on with the effects, and the sense of wonder isn't just like a cartoon kind of like computer chugging away ones and zeros making things appear in front of you. These were people behind each and every one of these effects. That's why Ray Harryhausen's stuff still stands up to this day, because there's a sense of artistry and of craft that's put behind every little detail that is put on screen. I think there's the effects are charming. I think that's a lot of what, you know, still holds people dear to these kind of films. It's why Clash of the Titans will never go away. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's obsolete nowadays, but it's still, there's something about those effects that are still wonderful and magical. And everything about this film, from the Rock Man to the Cocker Spaniel dragon, it's just wonderful to watch.
Mm-hmm. Either you, Derek, or I mean, I'm Glenn or Scott or Don, you got any further comments, things that stand out for you as far as the practical effects go? Like, for me, it was the wolf. I'll mention it right now. The wolf, to this day, that freaking face on the wolf is freaking creepy.
Mm-hmm.
I love puppetry effects. I love puppetry and all those kinds of it. Even though they don't look, you know, completely realistic, because, like, yeah, the mouths don't move and stuff, I find them more real than most computer generated effects.
They're tactile.
The fact is that watching, you know, that's an actual thing. You know, that was not something that was just a series of ones and zeros. This is something that actually has actual three dimensions. And it's something you can imagine coming alive at night and killing you.
I would probably, yes, but I would actually probably save anything that I was going to, that I would say about the joys of practical effects for our later films.
Sure.
Where we have the great Jim Henson up there. So.
Yes. But these are close to Henson. I mean, they really, in some of them, I think they really did great things with the camera angles and that as well, with the small couple on the hill, you know, interacting with the Treyu, you know, all of that. I mean, Don, would you say that couple on the hill, never Princess Bride, it has the feel of the couple from Princess Bride, Billy Crystal?
It absolutely does. The witch and the warlock. It really does have that same thing that old bickering couple feel. Ancient bickering couple feel.
And
not that I've ever been accused of that.
And after watching this, and I'm sure we'll find it with the other ones as well, I really think some of these later filmmakers who were doing the special effects designs were affected by these films. Not just the special effects, but some of the stuff they did, like the couple. Or there are a couple terms in the next film I want to talk about that bring up that caught me off guard while watching it. But I guess Never Ending Story, we all endear it very much for different reasons. Well, most of us, Scott has something against the, you know, Bastion, which
I don't like. He rubs me the wrong way. Now Noah Hathaway, yeah, he was great. He was great in this. He was great on Battlestar Galactica. But, well, you know,
let's not forget Alan Oppenheimer, who did Falcor's voice and the Rockbiter's voice and Gamork, which are basically some of the most memorable voices in there. Mm. Plus, he narrated at the end. And old Alan Oppenheimer, if anyone's familiar with him, he's a huge voice actor for us kids in the 80s, doing Masters of the Universe, She-Ra voices. I mean, he's done a lot. And I just wanted to throw a shout out to him that he was the voice of the main puppet actor, you know, the main characters there, the fanciful ones. And I just loved his voice for all. They were different for each of them. You couldn't tell it was the same guy. So, and well, for those kids out there, he also did voices in God of War 3 game. So there you go.
That's kids today.
Right there, Mark, the fact that you had one guy doing all those voices. A movie like this made today, they would have to have 12 different big-name stars doing each one of the voices individually so that they could market it better.
Well, it's what Shrek hath wrought, yeah.
Yeah, and it'd be CGI, too. This film wouldn't be practical. It'd be CGI if they remade it today, unfortunately. And, yeah, we know how we feel about CGI, and that's why I wanted to talk about these films. Speaking of this, we're moving on to Jim Henson film, the first of two that we're going to talk about, 1986, Labyrinth. Now, Labyrinth, starring, among others, David Bowie, as well as Jennifer Connelly, and directed by Jim Henson, and executive produced by Jorge Lucas himself, we get the story of the 15-year-old Sarah, who is tired of her very crying brother, which Toby, which I actually don't blame her for, wishes her brother Toby away to the Goblin King Jareth, who's going to keep him unless Sarah can complete the labyrinth in 13 hours. If she doesn't, old David Bowie's got another goblin for his stable. And this film for me, I watched it. I just literally watched it earlier today, and I got to tell you, I still love this film. I love this film for its total. It's just what I got out of later on, the Mirror Mask out of Henson, and even his earlier film, Dark Crystal.
I love Mirror Mask.
Henson managed to do what I haven't quite felt them see him do it today. First off, it's all practical effects, but to create an original, unique world. Let's face it, the stuff in Labyrinth is crazy. I mean, for me, the crazy character that stands out, one of them, are they're called the Fieries, I believe it's called. They're singing the Chillin' Down song. And they're guys who just take apart any appendage and throw them about and tension.
Yep.
I'm just watching this going, wow, who smoked what when they came up with this scene? Because
that was a total Muppets skit. That was the thing that reminded me most of the old Muppets shows.
Fraggle Rock.
The Muppets are monsters. A lot of them, they call them monsters. And, you know, there was some pretty, if you look at some of those old Muppet stuff, there was some dark stuff in those Muppet sketches, you know? And it was great. I loved it, you know?
So for you guys, we'll start with you, Glenn. What was one of your favorite puppet characters in Labyrinth?
Boy, now I'm completely blanking on his name. The knight.
Oh, the fox.
Yes.
Sir Reginald.
He's by far my favorite.
Oh, yeah, he's great. I'm watching him, and I looked at him and going, that character alone influenced at least half a dozen video game characters.
Did he miss? It says on the IMDb.
Yes.
That's it, yes.
He had to have influenced, like, half a dozen video game characters because of the way he was. He just, like, wow. He's a great character, too. What about you, Derek? What about your favorite? You got a favorite puppet, Muppet?
I can never remember his name, and I just watched this last night again. The little trolley guy that follows Jennifer Connelly around.
I think the
mixture of having a little person in with this puppet that had fully functional robotic eyes and a fully expressible face, it was an amazing puppet. I think the character itself is kind of a goofball and kind of all over the place, but the puppet itself I thought was just amazing.
Well, it is realistic. You forget that that's puppet, you know, puppet animatronics on someone's head.
Yep.
What were you going to say, Scott?
I agree. It would be that one for me. I actually always kind of, because they came out around the same time, and, you know, honestly, I saw Labyrinth, I think, once when I was very little, and it didn't really make as much of an impact back then. And it wasn't until years later that I watched it again, like many, many years later. But I always thought that, you know, the troll in Troll.
Oh.
I always kind of thought it kind of looks like, you know, like maybe like if Hoggle had like a black sheep in the family brother, he would be the troll in Troll, you know? Hoggle just wants to do his business, kind of gets pushed around a little bit, but that other guy, man, he's up to no good.
What about you, Don? Did you have a favorite puppet?
I like the old homeless, the lady that lived in the dump.
Oh, the garbage?
The garbage lady.
Backpack, yeah.
Yeah, I always liked her.
Yeah, well, she played kind of a pivotal role in the plot, too, at one point. So with the scene where she's picking stuff up out of the room and trying to convince
her to stay.
Yeah, this film overall, though, for a kid's film, is dark in every scene. I mean, what I loved about it, again, we have another one, though, and it was the running theme in the 80s, and it's something I wanted to touch on because with these two films specifically, because they involved human kids who were into fantasy, who were into something, they were kind of those odd kids. That was a running theme because back in the 80s, it was not cool to be geek. I mean, I there's storylines that you couldn't, I don't think you could do today as well, because with those same characters who were into fantasy and that, because that's kind of expanded into a lot of the kid culture now, is the stuff that they're oddballs about now. From what I've seen, it's kind of expanded into some of the kid culture, and you know, but you had that running theme of the bullied kid because he was into fantasy or had an imagination. She had that in here, and it was linked to a book as well. She had her book, The Labyrinth, which she read, and she was acting out. I mean, the first time we see her, she's in costume in the middle of the park acting out scenes, you know, with no friends or anything around. She's just out there.
It was actually quoted in the movie that her stepmother wished she was out on a date or with friends rather than constantly by herself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, it was another loner kid story, and that was actually popular. That's what was the main running theme for the 80s, it seemed like.
You know, Mark, it still is. I mean, yes, back then, I mean, now it is, the geekdom has become... And I'm happy to see it, honestly. It has become way more acceptable because I was that misfit kid. But you know, back then, yes, the misfit, you know, was often the hero. Who wants to hear about, you know, the popular kid who already everybody liked, you know? You know what? What has really exploded in the last 15 years or so has been the young adult book market.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? There, and honestly, I actually read some of them. When I did it, when I started reading them when I was going to be teaching kids, and I actually stuck. I go back to them still now and again because there's some really good stuff that they're marketing. It's just, you know, for a different audience, and so it's a little lighter. But if you look at the plots of many of these books, some of them are very dark, you know, like Divergent or Hunger Games, and some of them are a little lighter, like Harry Potter and stuff. Well, in the beginning, it's a little lighter anyway. But but if you look, the plots are very similar. This one young person, adolescent or a child, feels alone, feels kind of put upon. Feels like you know, the world's out to get them and everything, and they feel very alone. But you know what? They're special. They're part of a secret world that now they can access, whether they want to or not, whether they're ready to or not. And then the world opens up. This, I think, is a tradition that is continuing. I think that it is continuing in literature, and then now that the books are being adapted to films, now they're going to be done there. But I think in various forms that does the outcast being special, that every person has their own thing that makes them special, and the ones that you forget about have access to worlds you could never dream of. I think that is something that is kind of universal, a universal story that a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah, okay, I can see that. I guess maybe it's because it's taken from a different perspective now that I see versus the 80s. Maybe it's not as blunt as it was in the 80s or as, I don't want to say cliche, but as stereotypical. Yeah, I guess, you know.
It wasn't as sophisticated back then because, you know, these were kind of like the movies like Labyrinth and the stories like Neverending Story, I believe, were kind of like the prototypes for a lot of the things that were to come.
Yeah.
You know, so naturally they were a little more straightforward, you know?
Sure.
So.
With that, though, with the darkness, I mean, we first get into the Labyrinth, and what do we see Hoggle do but spray and kill fairies? You know,
after pissing in a lake, yeah.
After pissing, yes. I have that. I mean, Glenn, just the first 15 minutes, not even the first 5 minutes after Sarah, I believe her name is, shows up at the Labyrinth, you wouldn't see that in a film nowadays, would you?
No, not at all. Not at all. I also think there would be about 70 minutes less of David Bowie's bulge.
Yes.
Well, actually, if you consider David Bowie a whatever the, you know, 2014 equivalent of a David Bowie is, you wouldn't see that person cast in a kid's movie.
No.
No, that's what surprised me is when you have him as a cast, and actually he doesn't do that bad. I actually kind of like his villain of the Goblin King.
He's a great actor. He never got enough credit for the as good of an actor as he was.
I agree.
He nailed it time and again in the movies. He really did.
Oh yes.
I mean, his Jareth was actually a really cool villain. I mean, I'm watching this going, wow. You know, outside of the codpiece, you know, because. Let's face it, none of those Muppets outside of the big hairy guy were above his waist. So, but what else stands out for you guys with Labyrinth? I mean, there's just so much visually with this film. Jim Henson just paints everything from down to the littlest mice furballs moving in the background for me. This whole world. Anything stand out special for you?
Yeah, actually. Here's a little bit of amusing information. The owl out over the title credits that you see, that animated owl, is the first time that computer graphics were used to create a realistic picture owl or animal in a film.
Really?
Yep. So that's breakthrough for that.
Jim Henson being a breakthrough guy. I guess. what about you, Derek? Anything stand out to you, any particular scene or anything with Labyrinth that really stuck with you?
I think Labyrinth in general to me of, if we're just going to stick with the three films that we're talking about, is always been a film that has, on one hand, I admire its creativity and how far it's willing to push things, But on the other hand, because of its episodic nature, it grows tiresome for me. Mm-hmm. Like, halfway through the film, I kind of lose touch with it, and I've always felt this way, and I kind of stop caring. Mm-hmm. And unlike the other two films we're talking about, there's just something that feels awesome. And this is just me, obviously, because everyone else here really loves this film. I think it's wildly creative, and I love that about it. But I just think that it's kind of a little bit of a chore to sit through. So there's scenes that I really like a lot, but on a whole, it's never grabbed me.
This film is made, I think, also more for little girls, whether it's intentional or not, than if you ask a lot of people who grew up with these movies, you're going to hear a lot of little boys who are all snits and snails and puppy dog tails about Labyrinth. You know, yeah, my sister watched it, and the girls are all really into it. And I think it's because it has a very Alice in Wonderland sensibility. You know, it's told much like an old fairy tale or like Lewis Carroll's story from a young girl's point of view. And it's got a lot of stuff that's going to play. Not to stereotype genders or anything. It's going to play a little better towards young girls than it will to young boys. And David Bowie doesn't hurt there, honestly, this when I said it was a long time before I could watch this again. To be honest, this is the first time I had seen it all the way through in the last 20 some years.
Really?
I had watched it once when it came out on VHS. Like I said, I barely remembered it. Mm-hmm. And then years later, people just kept on talking about. All of a sudden, I heard all these people, mostly girls that were my age and slightly younger, talking about, "Ooh, Labyrinth, Labyrinth, Labyrinth." I'm really Labyrinth. You know, it never made a dent with me. So I tried to watch it about 5 years ago, and I didn't make it because. And this is going to sound, I don't want to sound like this, like, cynical, like, weird guy, like I'm coming off sometimes tonight, but here's the thing is that I watch a lot of horror films, as I know Glenn and Derek and stuff do. This movie, there are parts of this movie that freak me out way more than any horror film. And a lot of that
is the hands part.
The helping hands. Thank you.
The helping hands.
Helping hands. Here's the thing is that, and not to give too much about like the other life, other time that I had led, but you cannot just put this movie in front of somebody who has had experience with psychedelics without telling them what to expect. Trust me, if I still have nightmares about bananas and pajamas, yeah, this is going to mess me up. The helping hands are freaky. The farting swamp is freaky. The person who has another head on top of his head is freaky. And I didn't make it. I was late at night. I'm like, dude, I'm turning on the lights. And like, I could watch like all these. I have like zombie films. school children are getting cut apart like sliced bread in like these Italian zombie movies. And yet, nope. You know what does it to me? Helping hands, man. I don't know, and I know it's like this is the first time I was able to get all the way through it. I knew what to expect this time, so I was like, okay, here we go. And I honestly did like it. I did not love it, but mm-hmm. I did say I saw the charm of it.
I think you kind of capture exactly what I'm trying to express as well about is that I think it's kind of like there's parts of it that are so creative and so wildly imaginative and so fun to watch, but it just like after a while I think it just becomes because you see such weird stuff over and over and over and over and over and over again, and it's weird of me to say this because Dark Crystal is almost the same way. But there's something about that film that catches me, and this film, after a while, I get fatigued, and I just stop caring about it, and I just don't want to really watch it anymore. And it has nothing to do with, like, I actually like Jennifer Connelly in this film quite a bit. I think she's a great central character. I think she works very well in it.
Yeah.
It's just, I think it's a little too much after a while.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, just to throw in, Scott, what you were talking about with a lot of girls, Tanya Atomic, who couldn't make it tonight, but she wanted to.
Oh, this is good.
Just had a little bit of a anecdote about it. She goes, she didn't know how many women would be in the group, but apparently a lot of girls loved Labyrinth because they found David Bowie too hot. She said some of her friends called him the Bulge. and one friend has a Facebook page now called David Bowie's Labyrinth Pants. So go to Facebook now and look up David Bowie's Labyrinth
Pants. You know what? I didn't do that last night when she mentioned it. I think I'm going to now.
Mark, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but Tanya and I have a group called the I can't remember the full title because it's been a few years since I've been on the page, but it's the Sacred Cult of the Almighty Blue Shorts, and it's literally nothing but people posting guys in short blue shorts with huge bulges.
Yeah,
so it's kind of the same thing.
Well, that's what was funny about this too is I was trying not to notice with David Bowie, but there's one particular scene where he knocks Hoggle down, and the camera angle where it's at, I'm just like, you couldn't have picked a different shot for that one, really. I mean,
Hoggle.
I think Glenn sent me the picture. It's like his cup covers half the screen. I'm like, dude, really? Come on now.
You know what? I didn't. I just started typing in David Bowie's Labyrinth in Facebook, and I don't know if this is the same group or not. But the first thing I got up, and this is why I was giggling while you guys were talking, is the first thing I get is it just says David Bowie's crotch in Labyrinth, public figure. 13,000 people like this. That is a popular crotch.
Wow.
And it had somebody's drawn a crude white circle around it.
My God, that's really funny.
The production that they put into this, though, is...
It says 775 people talking about this. Right now?
and they graduated from Crotch High School in
2013. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, which makes that scene, because she's supposed to be, what, 15? It makes that scene where she's supposed to be forgetting about everything and they've got the masquerade ball going on even more awkward, because you've got David Bowie with... the young Jennifer Connelly in a whole ballroom scene that really is borderline going on, okay, this is getting a little risky. I mean, I noticed something too with this, and it's something that you wouldn't see in today's kids' shows. The first dancing couple that appears on the screen are two females. I just caught that while I was watching this film, and I'm like, wow.
Together?
Yeah, they're dancing together. They've got masks, but it's obviously two females, not an ephemeral guy and a girl. It's two women they're just dancing with
awesome.
Masks on. But it's the first scene and it's very quick but it caught me and I'm like, wow. And then you've got young Connelly amongst all these more adult people in a masquerade ball and the song that David Bowie's singing as well, just that's a whole awkward scene. I mean, Don, what do you think?
I actually, that was one of the things that struck me about the movie. I enjoyed David Bowie's music a lot, but a lot of his music in this movie was awkward and borderline inappropriate.
Look at my crotch.
I mean, if it wasn't the creepy... Humbert feel you had going on. It was just the goblins should not be singing in pretty, pretty melodies.
You know, normally, and I would agree on the you know the whole bad touch vibe of stuff. Normally, I for instance, the last movie I thought Falcor was came off really pervy, personally. But I like children. Atreyu, could you touch me? I just touched you while you were unconscious. Anyway, but honestly,
you guys are perverts.
Yeah, thank you. Just now figuring that out. Normally, this one for some reason I could easily have gone there, and it's definitely there, but it wasn't quite as disturbing because I think that. Honestly, it was kind of a thing with a lot. I want to say, wasn't that another element of a lot of like famous like fairy tales? These young girls who were being tormented by this kind of sexually imposing male figure. I want to say that was an element in that, you know. And it's not saying it's a good. I'm just saying it didn't shock me quite as much because it almost seems like, oh, we're going there, okay.
Yeah, but I mean, just it was still kind of awkward. And his music in general was really. I mean, I made a note of it in the opening song. He says the word hell. It hurts like hell.
Yep.
And this is a kids movie, and we've got the opening song. And now, granted, hell's not a big, strong word, but I'm putting in context of today.
Today, people have no sense of humor. They take like two cents. And you know what? You have to be so squeaky clean in order to get a G these days. These days, if you even so much as give someone a nasty look, you are PG immediately, even if you're a cartoon. And back then, this was, I think, came out in 86, so
yes.
PG-13 was only around for a couple years. PG-13 used to be almost practically interchangeable with R back in the day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, seriously, I mean, those first, like, 5 years or so, it was really not until, like, kind of like after Batman and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade that they figured out, okay, this is what we're going to do with PG-13. Because... And so you had a very wide berth of what was allowed in a children's film. And, you know, you'd get some, like, 700 club type people like, oh, look what they're doing to our children and stuff. I can tell you right now that all three of these movies, I was told in my old private school that I had to go to, religious private school as a kid, I was told I was going to burn in hell if I liked these movies. Point blank. All three of them. And they named them by name. Especially the next one, Dark Crystal. Ooh, baby. Because honestly, you know, because I think children, and we still do this today, we want to protect children. And sure, we should, because often they can't fend for themselves. It's a tough world out there. But you know what? Children are a lot more resilient than we give them credit for. And they can understand the world and can differentiate between things a lot better than we give them credit for. And so back then, did any of these kids turn into psychopaths because, you know, Bowie's perving on Connolly and he says hell? No. But today, yeah, absolutely, I agree with you, Mark. I think that you'd have the Catholic Decency League up in arms there.
Well, among other groups, but I think that's part of the culture, though. In all honesty, I mean, my kids, I don't leave them sheltered, but the movies that I saw by the time I was my boy's age, which is 13, my oldest, oh my Lord, I am so glad he hasn't seen them. You know, maybe it was our parents.
Would it be that bad, though? I mean, yes, you don't want to show them, like, say, like, Pieces.
I saw Conan... I saw Conan the Barbarian in the theaters, and if you do my age right...
I wasn't allowed to see that until
later. Yeah.
I think kids... it's all about the child. If the child doesn't seem like there's someone that can handle that kind of content, do not show them that content.
Right.
If they're a child that isn't scared by certain things, then go ahead and push it a little bit. I know people that show their kids... Evil Dead movies, and the kids love them, and they're totally good kids. Mm-hmm. But my daughter, and if you don't mind me transitioning into the Dark Crystal
I was going to go to the Dark Crystal.
About 2 years ago, she's seven now, about 2 years ago, my wife went out with her girlfriends, and it was just her and I, and we sat down, and I popped in the Dark Crystal, and my oldest daughter, she's usually a very sensitive person, and she's usually someone who's very skittish about intense movies. She doesn't like seeing guns. Guns, just the sight of them scare her. She doesn't like when there are people that are screaming in movies. And she just, intense situations in general frighten her. So I was a little leery of putting The Dark Crystal, because The Dark Crystal is a very dark film. The creatures are pretty grotesque in it, but there was something about it that she absolutely fell in love with. And I think it's the grandeur of, like, puppetry and the world that it creates, and that it is kind of fantastical, so it's hard to take it super seriously, and you can detach from it a little bit. But I think you always have to give kids the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. I think if something's too scary, a kid's going to let you know.
Yeah.
At least my kids do. You know me. I mean, the vast majority of what I watch is very, like, not appropriate for kids, and I don't ever force it upon my children. But at the same time, when they want to go that route, I think you let them a little bit. Mm-hmm. You gotta put your trust in children to be able to experience things. And these kind of movies, there is nothing wrong with them. Mm-hmm. They're really, I mean, if anything, they kind of broaden the horizons of a child of what is actually possible. Right. I think Dark Crystal is such a wonderfully twisted and imaginative film, but it's also at sometimes really kind of quaint and beautiful, with fairies and little elf creatures and stuff like that.
I will completely agree with you on all of that, Derek. My mm-hmm. girlfriend has two daughters that are 8 and 9, and I know they've seen all these movies. And her only real thing of what she will not let them watch at all is things that have actual, like, sexual content.
Right.
Because at that age, they're not ready for, like, flat out, hey, those two people, they're bumping uglies, and you can see the uglies.
they don't know how to process that. They don't know what that is.
Yeah.
But as far as, like, violence and even scary stuff, she'll let them try it and let them see, to get a little modern, the TV show Supernatural. They wanted to watch it because Mom was watching it, so she let them watch half an episode, and they got freaked out and stopped watching. But they watch, you know, other stuff that really wouldn't be, you know, that most people wouldn't consider. And I mean, they've been watching this stuff since they were, like, 5, 6. You know, most people wouldn't think, yeah, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is fine for a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old. Mm-hmm. But the thing is it depends on the kid and what the individual kids can handle.
You guys are completely right, because, you know, we remember that there's a lot of older films that are really scary. Wizard of Oz is scary, if you ask me.
Oh, yeah.
But you know what we didn't have to worry about as kids? I never once had my school go into lockdown. I didn't have to worry about a student or a teacher shooting my classmates and possibly me. You know, we didn't have a lot of the same things. We had other things. We had to worry about, you know, this will really tell our viewers how old I am, and I guess some of you guys as well, is that, you know, we worried about the nuclear bomb. We worried about the Soviet Union. Yeah. Yeah, we worried about, like, stuff like that. But that was like that, ooh, it's the unattainable thing that we couldn't touch. We didn't actually have it, like, affect us. I mean, into the extent of, it's in our school now. It's in my home. And I think that kids are able to process things better, because now kids, I think we do pamper them a little too much, even though they actually deal with a lot more. The kid will tell you, my friend Austin, who I do Film Geek Central with, he's a father. I think he's a fantastic father, and he has a very good system. He lets his kid watch things with him that I was like, ooh. I mean, nothing really too bad, but, like, you know, stuff that, ooh, a little instinctual thing, like, ooh, can the kid take that? Yeah, you know what? The kid can take it fine.
Mm-hmm.
Because of how he approaches it and what her level is and what she – and like Derek says, the kid will tell you.
Yeah.
You know,
open dialogue means everything. Having an open dialogue about what is being viewed and educating that child as to what they are watching, mm-hmm. and it makes a world of difference.
Listen to the children. Don't just shut the door to them. Yeah.
Wow, that was deep, guys. And
I'm
true.
I'm not
totally,
just dirty jokes.
I totally agree with you. I mean, my kids have been a little bit sensitive. My older one is more sensitive to death, things dying. Let's put it this way. A couple of years ago, we had him watch Edward Scissorhands, and he loved it up until the very end scene where Scissorhands takes out the bully guy, pushes him through the window with the knife, you know, the Scissorhands in his heart, and goes through the window. He's dead. We told him that he was knocked out because the only reason
he'll get over that.
the only reason at the time we did, and I know some people will say, well, you were a bad parent doing that, was because he was so upset by it, but he enjoyed the movie up until that point. I didn't want the movie completely ruined by him focusing on just that part. So then, you know, I knew where his level was for future movies, because then I'm like, okay, we, you know, because it was kind of a dark death. So, you know, but with dark deaths and dark movies, that leads us to Dark Crystal, which is a great discussion with the kids, but it does kind of lead me to Dark Crystal, which is probably the darkest film out of the ones that we've reviewed because of the subject matter and the things that actually happen on screen. Let's just say the draining of the essences from, oh, what's their names? The little guy.
Podlings.
That stuck with me to this day. And that's one of the most disturbing scenes I've ever seen in a kid's film, is them actually sucking the essence out. And what's funny is I ended up watching Smurfs, the new CGI Smurf.
Sorry.
Horrible, right?
Yeah. It really is.
But what they did in there, I'm like, these guys watched Dark Crystal, because they actually do a scene in there, find out why Gargamel is taking the Smurfs.
Oh, essence, that's right.
He actually is hunting them for the Smurf essences, and he drains them, and I'm like, oh my god, Gargamel's a Sketsy. So Dark Crystal, fantasy world, we've got you know, all kinds of things going on in this film. Let me just pull the plot synopsis up, because it takes place on a alien planet where you've got Gelflings, and you've got a Gelfling in particular that embarks on a quest to find a shard of a magical crystal that if he puts this shard back into this broken crystal, it will unify the world and bring it back to its once great glory, because right now it's split into kind of a dark and light world, and these two worlds really don't get along. Sketsy, for me, I will say the characters, the Sketsies, stand out for me as probably one of the creepiest, scariest villains in any film, much less a children's film, ever. Would you guys agree, Don? What about you? Would you say?
Absolutely. And I didn't think the combined creature was much less scary.
It didn't get better. I thought it was going to get better. Like, oh my god, that's creepy. Did that stick with you? That I mean, because they're the first guys we really see, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Whole intro of the film.
Yeah, is the Sketsies, and the one in particular, it's just like, these guys are creepy, and this is wigging me out. I remember watching it as a kid, and my uncle, my family used to scare me once in a while late at night, besides the E.T. three fingers around the edge of the door, which is a really creepy scene, I don't care what anyone says. Between that and Gollum saying my precious from the Bakshi, there were like three things that would scare the hell out of me. It was the fingers from E.T., Gollum from the Lord of the Rings rotoscope cartoon, and the frickin' Chamberlain. I got the Gelfling. Yeah, Chamberlain. Freaking creepy guy.
I did this.
I did this. This is mine. I loved Chamberlain, man.
Yeah.
He rules.
Chamberlain was great, but I mean, am I wrong? The Sketchy's probably one of the most disturbing villain puppets in a kid's film ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and you know what? The giant beetles are freaky too.
Oh, giant beetles. God, those things were crazy. But you're right, Derek, when you were mentioning it, that there are some endearing moments in here, too, with the Striders.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the scene with the Striders. You know, that's...
Bisgay!
I love Fizzgig.
Okay, who here didn't want a Fizzgig when they were young?
I was scared of dogs, actually, back then. I'm now a dog person. I was scared of dogs then because I had an issue when I was a kid. But I always did like Fizzgig. I wanted a Fizzgig to protect me because, like, that thing had, like, teeth for miles. You know? He had teeth for miles, and he was, like, ready to go.
But, I mean, the theme in general, would you say, Glenn, would you say this is a story that it almost felt like they took kind of an adult story and kind of tailored it for kids, but... This really is more of an adult film.
I actually think this harkens back to how stories were told to children way back when, where this, you know, you look at not the Disneyfied nursery rhymes, but look at the original, you know, Grimm's fairy tales and stuff like that. Mm. They were dark, dark stories. I mean, you know, Cinderella, I mean, it's not this, you know, oh, yeah, stepsisters were mean to me, and now I get to live with the prince. Stepsisters were mean to me. We're gonna stake him out for the crows. I mean, you know, that stuff was, you know, it was darker, and I think it harkens back to that time when you didn't coddle. It's a not coddling the child in that there is evil out there in the world. There's good too, but the fact is that there are bad things out there.
Right on the Wikipedia page, Glenn, to confirm exactly what Glenn said is totally correct. It says, quote, according to co-director Frank Oz, Henson's intention was to get back to the darkness of the original Grimm's fairy tales, as he believed that it was unhealthy for children to never be afraid.
Yep.
There you go.
But I thought the puppetry in this one, and it, what blew me away is this was 1982, but if you look at this film, you can't tell that it's 1982 that it was made because of the special effects. I mean, just all the puppetry going on in this film, it's what Derek was saying before, too, is why it stands the test of time, is because of the practical effects. I mean, can you imagine what this film had to be like to make?
Have you ever seen the documentary about the gentleman, and please push aside your thoughts about the guy himself. It was the documentary about being Elmo, and the guy who was Elmo, there's a section of that film where he discusses one of his first gigs was being a puppeteer on this film, and they go at length about discussing how this film nearly bankrupted them because of the sheer amount of money it took. Everything is all puppetry. There's a person for each and every one of these things that are going on. It was at the time some of the most advanced and groundbreaking puppetry that was ever put into a film or even attempted at the scale that it was at. It is truly a piece of art.
I think that to this day, this is one of the most amazing and imaginative films. Of the three films we're doing, this is by far my favorite, by the way, because everything they had puppeteers, acrobats, mimes. You know, anybody who says mimes aren't cool, look at the Dark Crystal. They can be cool. And they created an entire universe. Everything is a practical effect. And you know what? Today, you do the thing, and I actually don't hate CGI. I don't. I think it's a means to an end. One of the drawbacks to CGI that I've seen is that nowadays you look at a film and you say, wow, how did they do that? And there's a short answer, computers. This one, not computers. It was all this amazing thing. And no matter if you do look and say, how did they do that? Whether I was 7 years old when I first saw this, or 37 like I am now. Wait, is that right? I don't know how old I am. 38, actually. But no matter what, age I am is the point. Yes, you think, how did they do that? But also, you never once doubt the legitimacy of this world.
No, that's true.
Amazing. Yeah. An amazing film. Oh, I think we lost Dawn, by the way.
Right. Yeah, we did lost Dawn. Hopefully she'll be back here. That's the same thing for me, too. And actually, in all three of these films, though, with the sheer volume of practical effects, I think the acting is better by the performers because they have something there that's actually what it's supposed to be rather than a ball on a pole, you know, which they have now. I mean, would you say that the acting is probably now with Dark Crystal, it was all puppets. I don't. Was there a human involved in any of them?
No.
I don't think so. It was sheer volume of puppetry, but like with the other two, I think the acting was a lot better than it probably would have been had they just had a green object in front of them. But with Dark Crystal, it's just, you're right. You can't not believe in this world because it is so real, because everything is practical. It's there. It's tactile. It's visually textured there. The lighting is natural and it looks like it's supposed to. And yeah, and the movements too. I mean, you had Frank Oz behind it who basically made the best puppet ever. These are like a precursor to that. But with Yoda, you look at Yoda and the way they made Henson, because that was Henson, right, with making Yoda?
Yeah,
yeah, that was Henson and Frank Oz doing Yoda. And you look at that puppet, and you look at the puppets in Dark Crystal, and it's really a shame that nowadays they go so much to the CGI because it's cheaper, because I think it just added such a level of realism to have that practical item there. And they had people who were artists that could manipulate these things in such a way to make them feel real, because some of them nowadays, let's face it, that prequel Yoda was painful.
Yeah, I think that CGI is a means to an end. I think I said this in my Space Hunter episode of my show, to plug it. But is that I think CGI right now is a means to an end, and I think that sometimes CGI can be used to create amazing worlds like they did in Inception and Avatar and stuff like that. But you know what? I think that too much it's used as a shortcut, because you can do just about anything. And I think that because of that, they never think to even look at other options, and it has overshadowed everything, when there are so many other great ways to do it. And often the special effects become the story instead of merely a means in which to tell the story. Dark Crystal is filled with nothing but, like, every single scene takes immense planning and immense effects. There is not an easy shot in this entire film. And you know what? You never get the sense that the effects are the story. They are there to help tell the story, and that's really something that's amazing about it.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine Agra as a CGI person, which they probably do nowadays. I mean, she looked like a real person outside of the fact she could take her eyeball out.
She looked like my old bus driver.
She is one of my, in the DVD extras, all the behind the scenes stuff, one of my favorite scenes is with Ogra, where they have something goes wrong, and Frank Oz is the one who does her voice, and something falls down, so they go running, and he runs with Ogra, but she is screaming using Fozzie the Bear's voice. And Ogre's my favorite character in this movie. I love that character.
Oh, and Chamberlain.
What about you, Derek? Which character was your favorite?
I think not much, not really a character per se, but one of my favorite scenes of the film is the Beatles sequence. Is when the Beatles come in and then destroy her home, and there's that big, what is it, like the sundial or whatever it is, the machine that's running her place. That scene is so intense and so, like, you're on your edge of your seat, and it's puppets. And it's just so complicated, and exciting. I really think that scene always has stood out for me. It's just, it's amazing how they were able to do that.
Well, there's so much going on in every set, too. I mean, we saw it similar in Labyrinth, but you definitely see it here, is just so many little things going on that I think would get missed possibly nowadays to make the world feel real, just nuances. Like her lab, the machine that she had that was moving, that, mm-hmm. you know, or all the environments that they had, or when they're in, they're on the Striders and they're going through the prairie, and that you actually have little puppet flies and you have little puppet critters rolling around, and you have, you know, everything just, they really think of all the details. I mean, Dark Crystal, you can tell the planning. Could you imagine the storyboarding for this film?
Oh, my
God. Had to be meticulous. It had to go on for a long time to make this film. So many people had to be involved with this. But luckily, at that point, Jim Henson had a studio, and he had a built-in crew of people from Sesame Street and the Muppets and all of these other things that all, this was like the culmination of everything that they had worked toward, and this was like the big point of the mountain, you know? We're going to go for it. We're going to go for broke and make the most extravagant puppet film ever.
Yeah, and they, I think they, you know, succeeded, and all the themes that they have going on in this film, too, are things that you wouldn't quite expect from a puppet movie. It really was done like a movie, which I think surprised a lot of people too. At least, it wasn't done, oh, we're doing a movie with puppets. It's like the puppets are telling the story. It's a movie. It's a real movie. It's not being made like Scott said. We're not doing this to feature the puppets. We want to tell a story, and we just happen to be using this medium of puppets to tell it, but they aren't the focus. You actually have a meaty, dark story here that's got a legend to it and some, you know, some ancient feeling to it. And in general, yeah, Dark Crystal for me is probably one of my favorite all-time kids films to this day. And it's just, it stands up. You watch it today, and like I said, I mean, would you guys agree? You can't tell at all. It's from the 80s.
The only thing you can tell is that you look at it and you say, wow, they really used to take a lot more care with these movies, didn't they? That's the only thing is that fit, because, but technically, I think if I popped this in front of my niece and nephew, who I don't think have seen it, actually, I didn't tell them anything about it, I think, wow, this new movie is great. I honestly think they'd say it because there's really nothing there to suggest. It's not, it's a sophisticated, it's amazing. I think they'd dig it, actually. I'm going to show it to them. I remember, if you don't mind me just saying this, because this does touch on both the things you were talking about, both the theme of it and the technical amazingness of it, is that how I got exposed to this movie is my mom used to take me to a lot of the movies. My dad never liked movies. He doesn't like fiction. And my mom would always take me to the movies when I was a kid, and she knew I was like big into movies from a young age. So she said, Scott, there's this new movie coming out, and we have to see it together. It's called The Dark Crystal, and it's all with Muppets. I'm like, oh, I love The Muppet Show. I'm like, yes, I know you do. And it's all with Muppets, and it's like fantasy, and with like wizards and stuff. Like, oh, we're going. And we were so excited, and we went that opening weekend in December 1982, just a couple weeks before my detached retinas and everything else. We went to this theater and we saw this movie. It's like, oh boy, and we were looking at how amazing it is, and right away my mother is horrified. Horrified by, and, like, because of the draining and because the Skeksis are so scary. She'd be like, and so this is the one time, because she used to say, Scott, turn your head. You know, like Temple of Dooms, the heart scene, Scott, turn your head, you know, like like the Ghostbusters, the Zool scene, Scott, turn your head. This one, nope, I'm watching this, Mom. I got to watch this. She's like, oh, my gosh, she's turning her head, but I'm totally watching this. I love this movie. And I think that it was a generational thing that it really did do it, because I went to see it twice in the theater. I went to see it because they re-released it a little bit later, and I took my brother to see it, who is a dick. And my older brother is about 5 years older than me, and I was like, come on, Joe, oh, we're going to see this movie, we're going to have a great time, oh, boy, and I'm like, you know, by the time, like, 8 years old, I think, and yes, we're going to see this, and I remember seeing the movie, and the whole thing unveils, and then very at the, just the end, the credits roll, I turn to him, and I say, ooh, what'd you think of the movie, and he takes his entire Coke and dumps it on my head. So, wow. You can't please everybody. Those are my three Dark Crystal stories.
Glenn, when are we final thoughts with Dark Crystal, the technical and the story, would you...
There's so much to love about this movie. I mean, one, just the world itself is a character. It is the biggest character. It's just the setting. And it's so gorgeously rendered. And the fact that one of my favorite artists of all time, Brian Froud, did so much of the concept art that a lot of the Muppets were puppets, and the scenery was based off of. I mean, it's just, for someone who grew up reading, I read old folklore tales, and I had the whole Time Life Enchanted World series that, because my dad worked for the company that printed them, and I read all of these older folk tales and stories and fairy tales. This was like the movie I had been waiting for. It was so much like they went into those books that I read and they just put it on the screen. I love this movie. I absolutely love it.
That's great. And Derek, what about you? Any final thoughts with Dark Crystal? Anything more you...
The Dark Crystal to me feels like the final act of a long epic film. It's the world has been destroyed in the middle act, and here is two desperate people trying to just get through their journey to come out the other side. And it's oppressive. It's extremely depressing at times. But I think there's enough whimsy and enough grandeur and enough magic in it that even as a kid, and I'll go back to what I was saying before with my daughter, is that there's something to connect to. The characters, the little elf, the Gelflings, are so cute and so endearing that they're the kind of the glue that holds this really twisted mess of a film together. So to me, honestly, there's two films from the 80s that I remember watching quite a bit of this kind of genre. The Dark Crystal, and I'm usually not a big fan of Don Bluth films, but The Secret of Nim
is another movie
that I used to watch all the time for a lot of the same reasons that I love The Dark Crystal, is because it takes the wonder of being young and throws it into, like, the pit of fire. Like, it was nothing but oppressive darkness. And how do you use your smarts and use your wiles and depend on the kindness of others to help you along? They're both extremely great films. And of the three films, even though I said I watched the Neverending Story quite a bit, this film is one of my favorite films that have ever been made. It's amazing to look at, and it will stand the test of time.
Awesome. Well, we are hitting to the midnight hour here. We could talk about Secret of Nim quite a bit. That could almost be another podcast in itself. But I want to thank you guys for joining me tonight on this journey, looking at these three films, getting a chance to revisit them, get some perspective on them as well. I'm sorry Dawn dropped out, but we appreciate her adding her two cents in, so it wasn't a complete sausage fest tonight. and Tanya's anecdote. Why don't we just wrap it up really quick? Thinking of the future, thinking with kids movies today, do you think, and we'll start with Glenn, do you think that we'll see a film or films like what we had in the 80s again, or some equivalent?
I think you might, but I think it's going to be, it'll probably be one of those, it'll probably be kind of like a nostalgia type film where it's not really made for kids. Mm-hmm. It's one of those ones that's made for the parents, where it's like the you could take your kids to this as well, but it's made for us. And I think you're seeing some of that stuff coming out now because of the fact that the kids who grew up on Dark Crystal are the ones now who are, you know, calling the shots in some places.
Mm-hmm.
So you might. I don't think it's going to capture that same feeling. But, you know, I'm also saying that, you know, from the fact that as much as I want to still be able to look through the eyes of a child, I can't. I've seen too much. I've seen too much, man. I don't know. I mean, I would love it if they could. I would love if they could recapture that. But I also think part of me is the belief that you don't need to recapture it. It's still there. You can go and you can watch this movie right now. Kids can watch this movie now and still love the heck out of it. And they don't need something new. It'd be great if they had it, but, you know, they've already got it.
Yeah. What about you, Derek? Do you think that... Now, granted, again, we're all older folks, but do you think that they may come out with a film like this in the future? I mean, we've got Pixar films which are similar, but, I mean, just on, you know, that type of film like Dark Crystal, do you think we'll see another one like that?
I think there are films that I don't think you could possibly make a film like The Dark Crystal again, but I think there are films that aren't afraid to be a little dark. Paranorman mm-hmm. kind of comes to mind.
Yeah.
Also, Coraline.
Oh, yeah.
I believe that also was an extremely dark and kind of wonderful film. I think the majority of mass market stuff, like, you'd never see a film like The Dark Crystal get the kind of, you know, mass exposure that it did back when it came out nowadays, because the vast majority of the stuff is super homogenized, watered down crap like Frozen.
Which I love, but there it is.
I got to be honest, I couldn't stand that movie. But there, I say never give up hope, because I think there's always a place for every kind of art that's out there. It won't necessarily be made with the kind of budgets. I think you have to look elsewhere to the independent scene, because I think Coraline, it wasn't really a big hit.
No,
and
it wasn't.
I don't think it really ever found its audience until it hit the home market.
Yeah, you know? It wasn't marketed that much either. It was like the studio didn't have a whole lot of confidence in it. If I remember correctly, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot about Coraline, and it was in and out of the theaters, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a dark, very dark film, and I think there are those films out there. It's just, unfortunately, a lot of the culture now is caught up on this nostalgia kick, and nobody wants to take, the people with money don't want to take chances on films that may not necessarily hit big.
Right.
Especially children's films, when all you have to do is put some talking animals on a screen running around and toss a few little musical numbers in there, and there you go. You've just made $250 million in 3 days.
Yeah.
So that's the money talks. And unfortunately, dark children's films, because, you know, the religious right has kind of taken over, you know, what is being seen nowadays, we just won't see these kind of films out there anymore. You'll see them in the direct video market and on Netflix and things of this nature, but you'll never see them in the theater again, at least not at this time.
Right.
Can I be just a little bit optimistic?
Sure. Scott, I was going to say, sure, go ahead, Scott, with your final
thought. Yes. Yes, we will. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I agree with what Derek is saying. We have seen some dark things, but they have been smaller films. For instance, a film you mentioned briefly before that I love, that still a lot of people haven't seen, is Mirror Mask.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that was
fantastic,
like, blink
film.
Blink and it's gone, but it was a fantastic movie. And it was a smaller film, but it was amazing, and it's dark and everything like that. There's also other things like Stardust and such. Again, didn't do so great. But
all,
you know,
Neil Gaiman films.
Those are Neil Gaiman films.
Neil Gaiman.
which is weird because I don't like Sandman or anything. But you know what? But I'll tell you something. The climate is different. because you were touching on something, a lot of the you guys were both touching on something that a lot of the people who grew up on Dark Crystal and Labyrinth and stuff like that are now calling the shots. So now we are actually, I believe, living in a golden age of family entertainment. Because here's the thing, we love Dark Crystal. We love these other movies, but you know, from our youth, but you know what? We tend to forget in our nostalgia is that for every Dark Crystal, there were like 10 Care Bear movies.
Yeah.
And they were, family films were typically the most insulting to children's intelligence that you would find. And it was only like once or twice a year, you'd find something you'd be like, oh, this one, you know? Now I think we're seeing it more. I personally liked Frozen, but you know what? I'll tell you another one that I liked last year was the Oz Great and Powerful. Loved it.
See,
but I know a lot of people didn't dig it, but you know,
I enjoyed it, Scott. I'm in that. I enjoyed it.
I but hated it.
Lots of people did that. I loved it. But here's the thing: is that I think we're in this golden age. The climate is different, though, because it was once in a blue moon that you got something like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth and Neverending Story. And why? Look in the decade before it, the 70s. When did you have that? Never. You had to wait for a Ralph Bakshi movie. You had to wait for Wizards. You had to wait for Lord of the Rings, you know? Yeah. Otherwise, you weren't going to get it, you know? You didn't have these fantasy-based films because they didn't know how to do it and they didn't know there was an audience for it. Now, we're getting tons of fantasy movies, we're getting tons of family films, and a lot of them, the ratio is better. Yes, there's a lot of crap out there like Smurfs and Nut Job and stuff like that, but you know what? There's also some really good stuff. I think, though, like I said before, people do take themselves too seriously today. You mentioned the religious right. Yeah, those guys are, I hate them. But I think that the climate thing, weird thing about climate, it changes. Something else the religious right doesn't want to admit. But is that, and so whatever the mood is now, we've got all this stuff, so we know there's a market for it, and we know that there's an industry for it. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what happens when this kind of correlates to when people realize, you know what, kids deserve more benefit of the doubt than we give them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine that? It's going to be great, and we are going to see. Maybe we won't recognize it because we're old. This is our childhood we're going back on. It doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the next generation. We might not even recognize it. You might, because, like, I mean, 30 years ago, you were my mother, horrified by the dark. Oh, my gosh, no, this isn't Snow White. But, you know, I think that we might not even recognize it, but yes, there will be something that is really amazing that will capture these kids' imagination, and you know what? That'll fuel it for 20, 30 years to come. Absolutely.
Great. All great final thoughts, guys. Thank you so much for staying late and sitting on this Google Hangout. We're going to wrap it up here quick. As always, like a lot of these, let's start with Derek. Derek, where can we find your other stuff and you and where can people look you up?
You can find me on Facebook and Twitter. You can find my other podcasts that you boys are all a part of, Astro Radio Z. You can find that on Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr, and also on iTunes and Stitcher Smart Radio, along with our other podcast, Film Jerks, all on the same avenues. And go to the Facebook group page and join Film Jerks, where you can sit with us and talk about, you know, weird and obscure films with a whole community of weirdos. Also, I am involved with films and making films, so go check out IMDb if you're interested in any of that stuff. Otherwise, coming up soon, I have an anthology film that I've been making for 2 years called Hole in the Wall that'll be coming out this year. So please check it out, go to the Facebook page, like it, and we'll let you know when that finally hits.
Glenn, what about you, sir?
You can find me on Facebook and on Twitter. You can also find me on YouTube doing my reviews with the B-Movie Bunker. And to a lesser degree than Derek, I also am making movies, and I'm actually going to be shooting, hopefully, 2 shorts this summer, and my Kickstarter will be launching next week. So you can give me money so I can make movies, because I can record this on my own because I don't manage my own money well.
Hello, Abe. give away.
Scott, what about you, sir?
I write for FilmGeekCentral.com. I have not done it in a bit, but I'm going to be posting more again. I'm going to have lots of podcasts and other stuff in the works, hopefully. My main thing these days is I have a video web series that you can see on YouTube, though you can also find it on Vimeo, and I prefer you see it there because I hate YouTube these days. And it's called Moviocrity. That's Moviocrity. You can see me Vimeo.com/Moviocrity. Got a bunch of stuff, and basically I look at the fun side of cult and exploitation cinema, and it's everything from spaghetti westerns to Jess Franco films to science fiction to horror to fantasy to a whole bunch of stuff, and that's my main thing these days.
Awesome. Well, thank you, gentlemen, so much, and thank you, Don, who unfortunately had to drop out, for joining me on this. We'll have another spoiler room soon. You folks take care, and remember, with the spoiler room, the films may be spoiled, but the conversation is always fresh. Good night.